Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Ayman Al-Tamimi, who runs the Archive of Islamic State Administrative Documents and the Jihad Intel Database.
In this episode, we talked about the Islamic State's finances and economy, in particular, IS funding prior to 2013, how IS funds itself compared to Al-Qaeda, current funding streams, less often known funding sources, the evolution of IS's economy in the past year and a half, potential for IS exportation of its economic model to its provinces outside of Iraq and Syria, and the sustainability of IS's finances in the near to medium term.
Thanks to everyone who's supporting the show on Patreon. And if you're a fan of the podcast and you haven't signed up to support the show, you can check out the Patreon link in the show notes, where you can make a small donation to help support the podcast and get some cool rewards. And after the interview, we'll have a new hashtag social media segment covering postings from December 8th through the 14th. But for now, here's Aaron's conversation with Ayman.
One of the biggest issues that individuals have misunderstood or been fed conspiracy theories about by certain actors is related to how the Islamic State finances itself. To get the ground truth and reality on this, today we have Ayman Al-Tamimi on the show to discuss what he has found from the IS administrative documents he has recovered. Before we get to the immediate documentation, though, Ayman, could you maybe provide some background on how IS's predecessors were funding their activities and operations prior to, say, the 2013-14 time period?
Yes. So on the question of IS and its predecessors in particular, it should actually be noted that the broad issue of financing from within, within the territories they were operating, this was a very well-established pattern, and methods included oil smuggling and, most of all, extortion. And this particularly became entrenched after what was then the Islamic State of Iraq, which was established in 2006. It experienced significant setbacks in the period 2007 and 2009, but one of the effects of that setbacks, which was the result of the awakening movement or the Sahwa coordinated with the U.S. coalition forces within Iraq, was that the Islamic State of Iraq entrenched itself around Mosul and consolidated its extortion networks there. So even at the height of even when security was at its best in Iraq, which was around the 2010-2011 period, the extortion networks in Mosul remained a huge problem and were never really dealt with. As a result, even the Islamic State of Iraq, it had significant financial resources from within. And as you've also noted before, you know, if it had really been so weak back in 2011 in particular, it would not have had the capacity to dispatch operatives into Syria who would then go on to form Jabhat al-Nusra. And of course, this Jabhat al-Nusra was being provided with a significant degree of its funding, at least in the beginning, came from the Islamic State of Iraq. Even seized records from during this period, so the pre-2012-2013 period, really show that in terms of foreign patronage, which has been a staple for many jihadi groups, including in the Syrian civil war. But in the case of Islamic State of Iraq, it really didn't constitute much more than, say, 5-10%. And really, that's, I think, the same case today, if not even less than that.
Yeah, so maybe you could discuss or compare how what ISI, the Islamic State of Iraq, was doing with sort of what Al-Qaeda and their branches have historically done, since they have been far less self-sustaining in comparison.
Yes, this is certainly true. Although, you know, other Al-Qaeda branches will have tried to establish their own governance projects within various territories such as Yemen and Mali. But those projects ultimately turned out to be quite short-lived. And also in the case of the Syrian civil war, you do have some al-Qaeda-linked groups like Sukur al-Is. These groups were almost wholly dependent on foreign funding. And in the case of Sukur al-Is, once that funding dried up, they really had no choice but to merge themselves into a larger jihadi group that was more self-sustaining financially. In this case, it is Jabhat al-Nusra, Syria's official al-Qaeda affiliate. But in the case of ISIS, it's evolved into ISIS and now into the Islamic State or the Caliphate. The difference now, I guess, in particular for ISI for funding now is that there's much more real control of territory. So there are far more avenues for the Islamic State in particular to make money through taxation and control of territory. And actually, unlike before where there was oil smuggling, there is now real control of oil fields, particularly in Deir ez-Zor province in eastern Syria. Although, again, one must not exaggerate the proportion of income coming to the Islamic State from the oil fields of Deir ez-Zor province.
Yeah, definitely. That leads into the next question. So what are the main sources of revenue for the Islamic State over the last recently? You know, you hear a lot about the oil in the media, but it goes way beyond just oil. And as you've, you know, noted in some of the pieces that you've put out for my website and also the documentation you put on your own website.
Yes. So the most notable specimens I've produced in financing in this regard was the budget from Deir ez-Zor province, which spans a period of 23rd of December 2014 to 22nd of January 2015. Going into the total numbers, the total income to the treasury in that month was just under $8.5 million. In terms of the oil revenue, this was only coming really at just over $66,000 a day from Deir ez-Zor province. So I think extrapolating that out, it certainly doesn't really up to the figure of $1.5 million a day that being touted as oil revenue for the Islamic State. Certainly, one argument that you could make in counter to the data I presented is you could say, well, the memo was outdated and the IS may have improved its production capacity in the time since that internal budget. But even so, I think the extrapolation is still rather the comparison of the figures. It's 1.5 million still seems like a very high number. And I think the problem is that distinctions aren't being made as to who exactly earns what from within the oil industry. So in terms of the latest scoop that I gave out to The Guardian, which was Principles in the Administration of the Islamic State, which is kind of a blueprint master plan for the administration of the caliphate, distinctions are made regarding who owns what in the oil industry. So the oil fields have to be controlled directly by the Islamic State. And whoever makes an investment in those fields has to have a pledge of allegiance to the caliphate. However, it is allowed for people who don't have an allegiance to the Islamic State. It's allowed for them to buy crude products from these fields to produce derivatives and refine them, or to transport them and sell them, whether inside or outside Islamic State territory. So on that basis, then a lot of the people who work in the what you might call the IS oil industry, a lot of them actually are not IS personnel at all. They're going to be civilians, although, of course, the Islamic State's Diwan al-Rakaz, or Precious Natural Resources Department, will directly control the oil fields. But in turn, they've got to pay the personnel they've co-opted to work on these fields to maintain the infrastructure. So on the balance, then, in terms of the actual income to the treasury, the actual income to IS is probably going to be much less than $1.5 million a day from oil. On the other hand, confiscations and taxation, that because there are so many avenues for this kind of revenue and it is directly going to IS, proves, I think, to be a far more lucrative business.
Yeah. And related to that, have you seen at all an evolution in how they've been trying to get economic and financial revenues since, say, April 2013 when they first went into Syria, or even more recently after the self-declaration of the caliphate in June 2014? Or has it relatively stayed the same, more or less, you think?
It depends, I guess, on how you want to define terms. If you want to see Islamic, if you want to classify Islamic State taxation as simple extortion, then, you know, very broadly speaking, we really haven't seen a change. It's the same old Islamic State extorting money. You know, one of the clearest differences, though, is in terms of the capacity, at least, for what you might call the extortion, because when Islamic State, or when ISIS rather, first expanded into Syria in 2013, and then throughout the course of most of 2013, it wasn't an organized, coherent entity of territorial control. In most cases, it was the Islamic State being one of many factions on the ground in a particular locality. It is certainly true that they prioritized control of absolute control of border towns. So this is like for Azaz and Jarablus and Adana, these towns in northwest Syria along the border with Turkey. But in terms of the nature of the overall nature of the territorial control and actual influence, it's nothing like today, which was partly driven by the circumstances in which ISIS found itself in Syria and eventually having to fight all other factions in outright warfare and take control of territory by force and become the sole governing power. And so as that has happened and as territory was consolidated around Raqqa city, I think you then find the development of these increasing development of these avenues of taxation. Oil fields was still something they didn't really gain full monopoly over until after the caliphate was declared, because initially they had been driven out of Deir ez-Zor province in 2014 at the beginning of it, and then had to gradually fight their way back into it, which was then abetted by the conquest of Mosul, for instance, because it allowed for new weaponry to come to IS. But again, in the 2013 period, at best, it was mostly joint control with other factions and getting involved in disputes. So clearly the avenues have greatly expanded, in particular since 2013. If we look now in terms of since 2014, I say that not much has really changed, although there are some signs of financial strain that have come about, foremost because the Iraqi government stopped paying salaries to government workers in territories under its control, and territories under IS control, that is. So as the principles in the administration of the Islamic State makes clear, there's a clear basis for sanctioned principle for co-opting personnel who worked in prior governments. So, for example, what you would call the IS Diwan al-Khidmat or Services Department is really just the Mosul Municipal Office, and then IS was very happy for the Iraqi government to still pay the salaries of those workers, because not only did it lessen the financial burden on them, it also meant an avenue for taxation. But now, though, with those salaries cut off, you've seen certain measures they've implemented that suggest some signs of financial strain. For example, making students in Mosul foot all the costs for printing the new textbooks. And on my archive of IS documents, I've got a list of prices for printing out those new textbooks. So rather than foot the costs themselves, they've imposed it all on the local population. Clearly, I think, to fund the activities of its so-called Diwan al-Ta'lim, or education department. But in the overall assessment, it's not like we've reached I don't think we've reached a fatal tipping point for the Islamic State in terms of financial revenues. Yes, I mean, the coalition has helped cut off key routes like the Sinjar route, which would go to Mosul and was important for Syrian businessmen, for example, who would want to do business inside of Islamic State territory, and this would be something that would help keep up the cash flow. But again, I mean, evidence-wise, explicitly, I haven't seen anything yet that shows it's on the verge of total economic collapse.
Yeah, and to, you know, related to what you mentioned about the printing costs for these new textbooks, I was wondering if we could maybe drill down a little bit into the budget, since obviously there's more coverage of, say, the oil or them trafficking in archaeological products and the like. But as you've noted many times, there are other smaller things where they nickel and dime people, such as school fees. I was wondering maybe if you could talk a little bit about some of these other avenues that they have been getting funding from, even if it's on a smaller scale.
Yes, smaller scale. For example, fees for cleaning fees. So cleaning streets, maybe cleaning businesses. Also, fees between IS now and the prior systems is that electricity provision was much better under the prior systems. Certainly the hours of coverage provided publicly by IS is much less now in terms of numbers of hours. In fact, in Mosul, they didn't even have a public electricity system. It was really private generators. And then thanks to the Iraqi government cutting a deal to supply electricity via the Mosul Dam, this is why you get public electricity in Mosul. But in Raqqa, for example, they would operate they're operating the dams along the Euphrates, and this serves as a source of electricity for residents. But it's something controlled by the Islamic State, and that involves fees. But it then even goes into even more trivial things, and just the very sort of things we associate with a conventional state, like for example, fees for driving licenses, park permits, fines for violating public regulations in building, fines for traffic violations, all these little things. In the aggregate, as individual atomized entities, they might be pretty small, but you can see quite quickly when you take it all together how it adds up and why just pinning the financial lifeline to one source like oil is quite mistaken.
Yeah, I agree. And it also illustrates that there's a lot more to their state building and what they're trying to attempt than what usually gets coverage. Focusing on a different aspect of this, I was wondering whether you've seen anything related to IS in Iraq and Syria providing any money to its provinces outside of those territories, whether in Sinai or Libya or Yemen and elsewhere.
Unfortunately, I've not seen any such evidence. It's only on the anecdotal level. There's nothing documentary to show transfers of money from IS Central to the outside. I mean, looking at it in the aggregate, I would say it would be IS would really be financially straining itself even more if they had to maintain the budget of all those affiliates operating in territories outside of IS Central. Yes, of course, there are interactions between IS Central and the affiliates, foremost embodied in the Jaish al-Khilafah, the elite military of IS that is partly responsible for dispatching operatives abroad to help cultivate the affiliates, like in Sinai and Libya. As you've noted as well before, that clearly the groundwork was being laid for some time before those affiliates were officially declared. But I imagine actually the affiliates would largely have to find their own means to fund themselves. Like looking at the numbers from the budgets and say from Deir ez-Zor, in the end, you know, we're going at tens of millions of dollars a month on the overall scale throughout IS Central. But I imagine a lot of that most of that would have to be used to sustain themselves, to sustain IS Central itself, rather than the affiliates. And many of the affiliates also are not particularly. It's important to note that many of the affiliates, though, are. On the other hand, what you might argue, contrary to what I'm saying, is that many of the affiliates themselves aren't particularly well developed. Ultimately, of course, the Islamic State, given its emphasis on being a state, the affiliates are expected, I think, at some point to try to replicate the various D1s, system of D1s, departments that IS Central has set up. But so far, there's been very little headway in that regard. The only main example really is just is Libya, centered around the cities of Sirte, which is being portrayed now as this kind of fallback option for the Islamic State in the media, and city of Derna. But Derna, though, they were never the only faction there, and they got quickly dismantled. So at the moment, really, evidence doesn't show either way how far, if at all, the Islamic State Central is financing the affiliates.
Yeah, I think it's important here to note that all the other places besides, as mentioned, Libya, they're not quite as advanced or sophisticated along sort of the process of becoming more state-like. Many of them are still just purely acting as terrorist organizations or as more insurgent forces. But with that said, have you seen any attempts by IS to export their financial model to any of their other provinces outside the core territory? And do we know anything about how these so-called provinces are making money outside of Iraq and Syria?
Well, according to the Islamic State model, there should be a Diwan Bayt al-Mal, which literally means a house of wealth or money, which in IS Central takes the form of a greater Diwan, and then the provincial affiliates. And actually, according to the principles in the administration of the Islamic State, the provinces of the Islamic State largely have to take their assume their own responsibilities when it comes to financing. Like, they shouldn't have to, as a result of mismanagement, be referring to the central cabinet, so to speak. In terms of the affiliates, I haven't seen any one of them replicate a Diwan Bayt al-Mal to give accounting of finances, incomes, and expenditures. Although, again, this is based on the paucity of evidence that I've been able to obtain. So, you know, it's just because I haven't found anything yet relating to income and expenditures in the affiliates, it doesn't mean that, you know, there's no functioning Diwan Bayt al-Mal in particular in Libya, I'd say. Now, in terms of how the affiliates are funding themselves, I think they also largely do this via local means. I'm sure in Libya in particular, with control consolidated over Sirte, the same pattern of taxation and confiscations is emerging. And of course, also in Libya, there's not opportunity to exploit the oil industry. Yemen is another interesting case to look at, one to watch. Sinai as well. I'm sure in Sinai there's the smuggling routes of various contraband goods, and this is the kind of thing that the IS Sinai affiliate would exploit as well. That most of them are not particularly sophisticated in terms of a developed governance structure.
Yeah, definitely. At least from my research on Libya, we have seen that after they took over some territory, they started to confiscate old politicians and other factions' houses and properties and the like. And it's
very difficult.
Yeah. And it's believed that they're also, you know, taking fees with the ports as well, since it is right on the Mediterranean. You know, to circle back now to sort of the bigger picture, I think you alluded to this a little bit before, but I was wondering what your take was on the debate of the sustainability of IS finances, since there have been some articles about this recently. And how do you see their financial efforts evolving in the near to medium term with the increased military pressures?
I would say, with regards to a question of sustainability, I do see it as sustainable in some way or another. I mean, it's important to note that you know, the quality of life is not particularly good in IS territory all round, but it's not like the surrounding environment is necessarily all that much better. So in terms of comparisons, yes, there are clearly some deficiencies between now and then, and particularly, say, with electricity provision, but I don't think the quality of life is of such a difference that it would provoke a mass uprising against IS on account of economic deteriorating economic conditions. In terms of sustainability, I do see it as sustainable so long as cash flow continues between IS and the outside world, and there are still many ways for that to occur. Despite, for example, despite territorial losses for IS, because, for example, if you take the case of Tel Abyad, which was an important border town for IS, it fell out of IS control, and thanks to the efforts of the coalition backing the Kurdish YPG militias, backed by a small grouping of rebel allies, they took back Tel Abyad, and initially the Kurdish police division, the Asayish, tried to impose a blockade on goods and going between and personnel, people going between Raqqa City and Tel Abyad, knowing full well that, you know, this kind of movement provides financial sustainability for IS. But it seems actually gradually this has dissipated, because Tel Abyad is proving difficult to rebuild and administer, and people often find that their only choice for services and goods is to go to Raqqa City itself. Other forms of movement of in and out of cash flow, for example, the fact that IS allows for oil to be sold outside its territory and allows people from outside IS territories, in principle, to come to IS-held lands and make business investments, because some people choose to do that, particularly in Syria, because they find that the security environment, particularly when you compare rebel-held areas and IS-held areas, the security environment is much better in IS-held areas, well, partly because the regime doesn't, the bombing intensity compared to the regime bombing rebel-held areas is much less, and secondly, the fact that IS is a single faction administering control and not one of many factions provides some sense of order.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming onto the pod today, Ayman, and shedding light on an issue that many are interested in. I think many people have learned a lot from this now.
Thank you.
This episode's hashtag social media segment will cover postings from December 8th through the 14th.
During that time span, 6 foreign fighters were announced killed by various groups in Syria, while 4 foreign fighters were announced killed by IS in Iraq.
On December 8th, Jabhat al-Nusra shows off its Imam Abdullah bin Mubarak Sharia Institute near the Syrian-Turkish border.
Also on December 8th, Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen Darna shows off its Quranic memorization courses for children at the Abu Bakr al-Sadiq Mosque in Darna, Libya.
On December 8th as well, Wilayat al-Janub of the Islamic State cultivates winter crops in al-Zawba, Iraq.
Also on the 8th, Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State builds new boats for fishing along the Tigris River in Iraq.
On December 8th as well, Wilayat al-Kirkuk of the Islamic State has a meeting with the al-Ubayyid tribe in Iraq.
Also on the 8th, Wilayat Tarablus of the Islamic State has a qualifying exam for imams in Sirte, Libya.
On December 9th, Harakat Ahrar al-Sham al-Islamiyah graduates a new batch from its military training camp in Aleppo, Syria.
On December 10th, Jabhat al-Nusra honors outstanding students and graduates of its Sharia and Quranic Memorization Workshop Institute in Ariha, Syria.
On December 11th, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula broadcasts its recent video, Guardians of Sharia, in various places in Yemen.
Also on December 11th, Jaish al-Fatah in Idlib, Syria distributes flyers after Friday prayers detailing women clothing restrictions.
And finally on December 12th, Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State helps the al-Zubayd and al-Jubur tribes reconcile differences. If you have any feedback, you can email us, podcast@jihadology.net, or find us on Twitter, where we are @jihadpod. If you're a fan of the show, please check out the Patreon link in the show notes, where you can make a small donation to help support the podcast and get some cool rewards. As always, our show is available on iTunes and Stitcher, and if you use one of those platforms to subscribe to the podcast, please take a moment to rate and review the show, which will help more people discover the podcast.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks to Ayman for coming onto the show and sharing his expertise with us. Also, thanks to the Podmaster, Carl Moran, for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly. Until next time, I'm out.